This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. Time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your host, Drew Tignanelli.
This is Drew Tignanelli here with Money, Riches, and Wealth. Co-host Tommaso Vincenzo Giuseppe Bombasuto.
Yes, sir. Good evening. I love our new music.
You love it. That's good. You're just sitting there and bopping along there,
that's
Tom.
Right.
I noticed
that's
right. That, you
it's
know.
Fun.
And we have a guest here with us in the radio station,
yep,
just as a visitor, and
yep,
it's our director of tax and accounting for,
yep,
the financial consulate, who hangs out in Gettysburg, Robert Boner. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing great, thank you, and I've listened to the show, and I just had to see it.
Yeah, well, we're great to have you. You were down with us all day today.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big birthday day today.
Yeah.
We had numerous people in our office's birthday today, and it was great to have you with us. And but we have a guest tonight.
Yes, we
do. We're going to be interviewing a person that wrote a book that is nothing, you know, it's not like there's groundbreaking material in here, but it is probably the most important thing every investor should keep in mind when they're investing. So tell us who we're talking to tonight.
Drew, we've got Gary Smith, and he's a professor, the Fletcher Jones Professor of Economics at Pomona College in Claremont, California. Got his bachelor's from Harvey Mudd College, PhD from Yale in economics, so he definitely knows about his numbers. He's written a bunch of different books, and including books on statistics, which is always exciting. It's riveting. But you know, this is a value book we're going to talk about today. We've got Money Machines. Gary, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Gary, I hope you didn't take it as an insult when I said there's not any groundbreaking material in here, but I mean it in the sense that too many investors invest for all the wrong reasons, and you're reminding them in here what they should be thinking about.
Well, that's exactly right. And, I mean, the things I'm saying go back to Warren Buffett, Benjamin Graham, John Burr Williams, you know, decades, except most people ignore them. And so most people are speculators. And the way speculators work is Apple's about to announce a new iPhone, and so you think, oh, maybe the Apple stock will get a little bounce out of that. So right before the announcement, right before the event, I go out and buy a bunch of Apple stock, and then I watch the blog of the event, and I watch the price go up and the price go down, and every time it goes up, I get happy, and every time it goes down, I get sad. And by the end of the event, it turns out I'm sad because the price went down. And
then a day or two later, you sell it, right? You made 10 cents or you lost 20 cents or whatever, and you think you're a great investor.
That's what speculators do, is they buy a stock hoping to sell it to someone else for a somewhat higher price a short while later. It's called the greater fool theory because you pay a foolish price hoping to find an even bigger fool than yourself to sell it to. And it's a very natural thing to, when you buy a stock, to think about, I wonder what the price is going to be. I hope the price is going to be higher, and that's why I'm buying it. And value investing, like I say, goes back decades, and it's the one proven thing that works, and it works for two reasons. One is speculation is stressful. It's not fun. And the second thing is it's almost impossible to predict short-term price movements. And
right.
So speculation is just fool's gold, and it's not a fun life.
So you
and then what a value investor does is say, well, here's a company, Apple. It's really well managed. It's got great products. It's got a lot of people who love the company. It's got good earnings. It's got good dividends. It's got a pile of cash. I'll just buy that stock and hold it for 5, 10 years, maybe 10 years down the road. Company's going to be bigger. The price is going to be higher. Meanwhile, I'll have 10 years of dividends, and I'll be happy I made that investment. And
so
Warren Buffett once said, I buy on the assumption that they could close the market for 5 years. And the idea is you buy something intending to hold it for a long time and get the cash out of it.
So, Gary, hold on a sec, okay? And
I'm
that
sorry,
is,
I got excited there.
I know, you were doing great, you know. But, one thing that you have going for you that I think anybody who wants to be a serious investor should do, and that is when you really first started to get into investing, you had a mentor. And you actually dedicated the book to him, and
mm-hmm,
he's an incredible figure in economics and money and markets, James Tobin.
Yep.
What credit do you give to having a mentor like that?
Wonderful because he was a Midwestern boy. He grew up in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, and he had Midwestern values. He was honest and hardworking and cared about others, generally cared about others. And when I wrote my thesis under him, he gave me advice all along the way. He actually read the thesis carefully, changed some of my grammar, and he was just a wonderful guy. And when I first started teaching investing, I asked him to recommend a textbook. And he said, John Burr Williams, which was not a textbook at all. It was a PhD thesis written by this guy at Harvard. But it was exactly the right thing to read, because he is the grandfather of value investing. And he was the first one who talked about, think of stocks as money machines. Think of stocks as things that generate cash. And think about, what would I pay to get this cash, to get a dollar a quarter, to get $2 every 3 months, to get $5 every 3 months? What would I pay for that? And stop thinking about what the price is going to be on Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday. And that started me on this whole value investing thing.
Yeah, and so, you know, what you just said there is so important, because what we're going to talk about when we come back from our first pause in about 30 seconds or so is, so many people invest, like you say, because they're going to try to buy something on Monday and sell it on Tuesday and make 50 cents or a dollar. Or they're going to they got a hot tip from their friend, and you have some
exactly.
great stories of the hot tips from the friends. Or you got, you know, they heard that something is going to cure cancer and they're going to get on it before, you know, it's like all the people buying the marijuana stocks right now, you know,
yep.
because everybody's going to smoke marijuana in the country. It's going to be a $50 trillion market, of course, and every marijuana stock is going to make a lot of money. I'm going to get in on it on the early, you know, and that's
yep.
the way people think about investing. And it's foolish. It's just downright foolish. So I want to talk more about that, but we have to take our first traffic pause, and then we're going to come back. You're going to tell us more about how
Great.
To really invest, okay?
Great.
All right, hold on, Gary. We're going to take it away. Traffic.
Personal finance has become a major area of stress due to the increasing dangers and complexities of the global economy. Personal financial management is a comprehensive approach to combating these issues, and the financial physical is the first step. This is Drew Tignanelli, host of Money, Riches, and Wealth, and president of the Financial Consulate, an independent, fee-only firm. The Financial Physical begins with an objective analysis of your personal finances and ends with a plan to help achieve your goals. Experience the difference of the Financial Physical and learn how personal financial management can revolutionize your financial well-being. To learn more about the Financial Physical and the other services we offer, call us at 410-823-SAVE. That's 410-823-7283, or the easy way to remember that, 410-823-SAFE, or visit us online at drewtig.com. That's drewtig.com.
We're back, Money, Riches, and Wealth. We're here with Gary Smith, and we're talking about money machine, how to really make money in the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and the average person... you know, Tom, you know this as well as I do. The average person thinks that there's this web of really in touch, you know, in the know
right.
type of people on Wall Street that make 50 and 100% on their money every week.
Right.
And if they could only get that information, they too will make millions and millions of dollars. But that's reserved to just a few people that are, you know, doing these, you know, they have all the inside information and they're cheating and they're doing all this kind of stuff. And what Gary, what you're trying to tell everyone is no. Investing is understanding what you're getting, what price are you paying for it, and being happy with 10, 15%, if that, per year, and not worrying about if you do you make 5 or do you make 20, but you're going to make something over 5 years or 10 years.
Exactly. I want to follow up on something you said before the break. I had a former student came out from New York and California yesterday morning and came by my house. We talked. And he works at one of the big Wall Street firms, and he said most of the people there are exactly like the kind of people you described before.
Really?
And that they just, they're looking for stories.
Hmm.
They're looking for, oh, here's a hot story, here's a hot news tip, here's something, and if I act on it, I can make 50 cents in a day or 50 cents in an afternoon.
They're doing that hot story for themselves, or are they
selling
it
to
clients?
For the clients.
Get out of here.
And so instead of saying, I'm going to put together a portfolio of 10 great companies, they're saying, I'm going to find some company where I think a hot news story is coming out tomorrow, or like you say, marijuana or cybersecurity or something with a story. And I'm going to buy it regardless of the price, regardless of the profits. It doesn't matter as long as it's got a story. And value investing is exactly the opposite. The company's got to have profits. It's got to have dividends. It's got to be a real company, not just a story, a company that might be.
Well, that's why the indexes outperform the average investor, because they are just buying those companies with earnings and with dividends, and they're just holding them for 5 or 10 or 15 or 100 years. It doesn't matter.
And it's not just the average investor. The indexes beat the average fund investor.
Yeah.
The average,
these are the professionals, right?
Yep. The average professional does worse than an index. And so and it's because they're chasing dreams, and instead of just buying a good portfolio, they think that jumping in and out of the market, they're going to make more than other people. And it doesn't work that way.
And they're always looking, Gary, for some new trading technique, like technical investing or momentum investing, et cetera.
Reaction investing.
Reaction. You know, there's a whole ton of them, you know, and they say, oh, these work, absolutely. But just simple index investing actually beats all of them all the time.
Now, you made fun before of statistics. Let me stick in a little bit here. The problem with a lot of the stuff like the momentum and the reaction or all the artificial intelligence black box investing is it's very easy to find coincidental patterns in any kind of data, even random coin flips. And so you start scouring through the data and you find, oh, look, here's some kind of momentum. And if I had bought when the price started going up, I would have made some money. And then you buy it, and all of a sudden it's as likely to go down as it is to go up. And the same thing with reaction stuff, that there's always coincidental patterns in data. And so finding some new secret formula or recipe for investment is usually just finding a coincidence, which is worthless.
Yeah. You know, now, it was Tom that made fun of statistics earlier,
okay,
me.
Sorry.
Well, wait a second. It's because Mark Twain, right, he popularized, there are three kinds of lies. There are lies, damn lies, and there's statistics.
Yep.
And I was a math major just like you there, Gary, and I know that we can manipulate statistics to say all sorts of things, and that's what you see going on out there is people are selling stuff, and you got to be careful when people are trying to sell you these hot things. And what you've identified and reinforced is that value investing is time-honored and tested. Dividends matter. And value investing works. Now, there are traps. We talk about, value traps. You talk about that a little bit, catching the falling knife, things like that. But there are ways to go about doing this. But we just live in a culture that people are not patient. There's no patience in our culture.
That's the main thing. And it's not just stocks. I mean, it's in marriages, it's in families, it's in jobs. People are greedy. People are fearful. We do a lot of things for emotional reasons that don't make sense. It's just part of our human nature. I don't know if it's just our society or it's just all humans everywhere, but we're often dragged around by our emotions and do stupid things because of that.
You know, Warren Buffett did not become Warren Buffett because he got some hot tip on some hot stock and so forth. He just understood that a company that makes good earnings and consistently makes those earnings is going to continue to make those earnings and continue to compound them. And it's pretty simple. And he didn't make 50 and 100% a year. He made 20 and 25% a year. But it was consistent patience.
Mm-hmm. I think part of it is when you get these high testosterone people together in New York and they all start bragging and and competing, either they follow the herd or they start doing foolish things to beat their competitors. And I think part of Warren Buffett's secret is he's not in New York. He's out in Omaha.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And he's just making up his own mind without paying any attention to anyone else. And that's part of the secret to value investing is controlling your emotions, not being pulled around by your emotions or pulled around by what other people are saying or doing, and just think for yourself.
Now, you tell a hot tip stock story in Crossland Bank. This is one of your best investments you've ever made, right?
No. It's one I learned from.
Okay. Well, it's always a failure.
Fred is a great investor and manages a lot of money, and he gave me this hot tip, and it turned out to be a bad tip, and I learned from that.
So tell us what happened a little more, because so many people do this. They say, oh, gosh, my neighbor is whatever, and he's buying, she's buying, and so.
Well, he had some story for me about how this big savings bank in New York owned all these properties, and that was worth something, and it also had all these tax losses, and that was worth something. and somebody was going to take them over and buy the company for the properties and the tax losses. And it didn't happen. The company went bankrupt before that ever happened. So.
The FDIC took it over before you could make your millions.
Yeah. And I learned from that. The smartest investors in the world, you got to make up your own mind, make your own decisions.
So we always say this, Gary, is that making money in the stock market is about understanding what you're buying and what it's worth, and then paying attention to what price you're paying for what it's worth.
Exactly.
And so how do you do that? I mean, you have formulas in here and so forth.
Yeah.
Talk about it a little bit, and we've got about 3 minutes or 2 minutes. Give us just a little, and then we'll do more after the 6:29 break.
Well, one thing was another one of Warren Buffett. And one thing I love about Warren Buffett is he has all this great advice. And one thing he says, if you don't understand it, don't buy it. And so...
Yeah.
First of all, stay away from companies. You have no idea what in the heck they're doing. Stay away from that. What my starting point is actually, it's simple. I look at Fortune's annual list of the most admired companies, and these are all companies that are they've got great products, they've got great management, they've got great employees. You know, companies like Apple and Disney and General Electric and Facebook and Johnson & Johnson and Nordstrom. Those are all great companies. So I start there. I don't want to have some fly-by-night company that's going to open a marijuana store in Indiana or something. I want some company that's been around for a while and has good products and has a loyal client base and makes money. And then the second thing you look at is just, well, how high is the price relative to the money it makes? And so you compare the price to the earnings and the price to the dividends, and you get a sense of whether it's cheap or expensive. And you don't want to try and time the market like, I'm going to buy it at the lowest possible price and sell it at the highest possible price. You just say, well, here today, here's a company, pays 2% dividends. 10-year treasury bonds are paying 2%. So that's about the same, except the dividends are going to grow over time. With a good company, they're probably going to go 5, 10% a year. And so I'm probably better off buying this company than I am buying treasury bonds, especially if it's a good company like Apple or Disney or Johnson & Johnson or Nordstrom or Unilever. Companies that are going to be around for a long time, and it's simple. It's not rocket science.
But you do have times where those dividends or the stock price may be a little high, and they may be in danger of cutting their dividend, and that's what you're going to explain to us. How do you prevent that from happening, that you buy a stock? I was looking at one today that cut their dividend about 10 years ago, and will they start it again? How do you prevent from getting into that company? And that's what you're going to explain when we come back from this traffic pause.
Will do.
And then we're going to talk more about value investing. But right now, we got to go to traffic. Take it away, traffic.
75% of adults agree they could benefit from advice and answers to everyday financial questions from a professional. This is Drew Tignanelli, host of Money, Riches, and Wealth, and president of the Financial Consultant. We strive to serve as a leader in educating the public on personal finance topics through our Financial Pulse and Consulate Journal. For these publications and learn about our personal financial management services, visit our website at drewtig.com, and follow us on Twitter at TheFinCon for educational updates.
And we're back, Money, Riches, and Wealth. What is that? Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, you really got a hold on me.
I think Bob probably knew that because Bob's our music guy.
Are you a music guy, Bob? Did you know that?
Yes, I knew that.
You did?
Yes.
So then at the next break, when he comes back with a song, you're going to name that tune in three notes.
Okay.
Three notes. One, two, three. Ready? Gary, we're back with Gary on Money Machine, and I can't even remember what was the question I was going to answer for me.
Well, before I answer that, Gary, we also, you know, how do people get your book, and how do they get in touch and follow you a little bit?
Well, the book is easy. It's on Amazon, of course, and other places. Or you just find my website, which is GarySmithN.com. And it's got GarySmithN.com. And it's got all my books there and some words about me. kind words since I wrote them myself.
And if you Google Gary Smith Money Machine, you probably would find your website and everything.
Oh, yeah,
it'll pop right up.
Right.
That's great. That's simple. He's right there. So I remembered the question I was going to ask Jiz. So, you buy these dividends, they're going to grow and so forth. But what if you make a mistake and they cut their dividend? How do you prevent from picking that company that could cut that dividend or not grow them like you think they're going to grow?
Well, there's no certainty, but my starting point is you pick the companies on the Fortune's annual list, companies like Apple and Disney and Johnson & Johnson and Nordstrom and Unilever, and you hope that they're financially strong enough and sound enough that they're not going to run into trouble and be worried about bankruptcy and have to cut dividends to save the company. I mean, there's no guarantee. Things could happen. But if you start with a financially strong company, it's less likely to happen than if you buy some fly-by-night company who's selling a story.
Now, another thing you can do, and you talk about this, you prefer the dividends and the dividend growth, but you also talk about, companies like Meet Robert Shiller CAPE ratio. Mm-hmm. So you're looking at earnings, and even though they don't pay dividends, they may have consistent earnings. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, there are companies like Berkshire Hathaway that pay no earnings, and they're obviously great companies. And Google doesn't pay any earnings, and it doesn't pay any dividends, and it's a great company. And so how do you value a company like that? And the idea is that if it's got some earnings, just make up some number, $10 a share, and it's a great company, and it's growing, its earnings are growing, and 10 years from now, maybe its earnings will be $20 per share. Maybe it'll double. And so its price probably will double, too. And so you didn't get your return in terms of the dividends, but you did get it in terms of the capital gains. And dividends are money in the pocket, which is better than reading about money in the annual report. But some of these companies, like Berkshire Hathaway's philosophy is, if we pay out dividends to our shareholders, they can invest it and make 5 or 10%. But if we keep their money, we can buy stocks and make 20% for them. So our shareholders are better off if we make investments on their behalf. And so far it's worked. And so for value investors, the puzzle is, how do you value a company that doesn't pay dividends? And the answer is simply that if earnings grow, price is probably going to grow too, and so you'll get your capital gains.
Now, one of the things you talked about that I thought was fascinating is you absolutely say a company that's repurchasing their own shares is a big negative in your mind.
Well, it's a non-event, and so people often say, you take a company that repurchases half its shares, and so it's just doubled its earnings per share, and well, doubled the number of last year's earnings compared to this year's shares, but where did it get the money to purchase half its shares from? It must have liquidated part of the company or borrowed a whole lot of money, and so its earnings next year are going to suffer, and if it, sold off half the company in order to use the proceeds from selling half the company to repurchase the shares, then true, the shares are down by half, but the company's down by half too.
Well, that's exactly what IBM did. They borrowed all the money they've used to buy shares back. It's been pretty much borrowed.
And so they loaded up on a lot of debt, which is going to hurt their earnings in the future.
And the record of companies buying back shares is pretty negative. Their timing is usually pretty off. In terms of buying.
I want to go back to another thing you said, which is, can prices ever be too high? And obviously, they can. You and I lived through the dot-com bubble.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Yep.
And so right now, I said, the average S&P 500 stock is paying about a 2% dividend, and 10-year treasury rates are about 2%. Back at the dot-com bubble in 2000, 2001, the average S&P 500 stock had a 1% dividend, and 10-year treasury rates were above 6%, 6.5%. And so that was a huge difference. And stocks at that time were not attractively priced relative to bonds. And if you look at the companies and the dot-com companies, it was even worse because most of those companies had no earnings at all. They had no earnings, no dividends, nothing. All they had was their story. And one of the few companies that actually had earnings, Yahoo, didn't pay dividends, but it did have earnings. Guess what its PE was, its price-earnings ratio?
400?
Higher.
Really? I can't remember what it was.
Yeah.
It was. I just looked it up right now during the break. because I wanted to make sure. It was 2,375. It was selling for 2,000 times earnings. And
now, you also...
people were buying stories. I mean, they weren't buying...
buying stories,
dividends.
Yep.
They were buying stories.
Yeah, we had one in Baltimore called PSINet. It was a stadium named after that.
Right.
And they went bankrupt. That's the death knell. You name a stadium after your company.
See, now, Gary, you were actually around for another even more interesting time for the big companies, the Nifty 50 of 1969. Yeah. So tell us about what was happening then.
Well, there was a time when investors did pay attention to dividends, and they figured a $10 dividend on a $100 stock was a 10% dividend, and some people thought that way. And then people started learning, partly from John Burr Williams, partly from Dodd and Graham, that growth has some value, because compared to treasury bonds where you get interest, which doesn't increase over time, if you buy stocks, the dividends grow over time. And so then as we humans tend to do, we swung way too far in the other direction. And all we're looking at is growth, and the more growth, the better. And so they took these companies whose earnings were growing at 5, 10, 15% a year, and they assumed they would grow that fast forever, and that literally, people would say there's no price too high to pay for a growth stock. And so companies were selling, not as bad as Yahoo, but companies were selling for 50, 90, 100 times dividends. And a lot of those companies are no longer around. Some are, but, you know, Avon, Xerox, company Kodak, a lot of those companies, the growth stopped the way growth has to stop.
Is there similarity to that and the FANG stocks today?
There's some similarity. The thing is that they haven't... FANG stocks are hard to think about because they're so short-lived. And so you take a company that's had rapid growth and it's gotten really, really big in terms of its earnings, and you think, well, that can't continue forever. And the FANG companies, I'm scared of almost all of them except Google. For some reason, I have a lot of faith in Google. But the other ones, they just scare me. So
just for our listeners that don't know, FANG stands for, Thomas?
Facebook, Amazon,
Netflix,
and
Google, which is now Apple. So it's really FANA.
Well,
Some people throw Apple. Yeah, Apple, I love Apple because they actually pay dividends.
Is it Apple that's in FANG, or is it Amazon?
It's Amazon.
Amazon,
the
Netflix.
Companies that don't pay dividends.
Now, what about Amazon? You know,
Apple now is thought of as not a growth stock. It's thought of as a mature company.
As a dividend.
As a dividend company, which is great.
That's right.
There's nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with a 2% dividend. It's wonderful. The thing wrong with Amazon is they're not profitable. And you probably the only thing profitable about them is their cloud services and all their shopping stuff they lose money on. And the policies they have are just crazy. I mean, I'm sure you shop at Amazon too, and so you have Amazon Prime, and you order something, you don't like it, you send it back, they pay for the shipping.
Now, Buffett said, I think in his annual meeting, didn't he say one of the biggest mistakes he ever made is not buying Amazon?
It's one of those things where the price turned out to go very, very high. The guy I was talking to yesterday from Wall Street, I asked him about Amazon, and he said, number one, he doesn't know if it's ever going to make any money because Bezos doesn't seem to care about making money. And the second thing is that they actually, if his plan comes true, that they come to dominate retail, he thinks the government will break them up. They will not allow a monopoly.
Now, wouldn't doubt it.
If Amazon realizes its dream, the bubble will probably pop it.
Yep.
It's broken up like AT&T was broken up at some point.
Yeah.
Gary, you got to hold for us. We've got to take that last pause. We're almost through the show. I love these great guests because when we have a great guest, things fly and we have great information. But right now, we got to take a traffic pause. We'll be right back. Money, Rich, and Wealth. Yeah. Is it?
Let's think of Fleetwood Mac.
Fleetwood Mac, you got it right.
Yep.
What's the song? Come on, I don't even know this. I shouldn't say that. What's it
Shannon?
Called? Shannon? No.
Nope.
Which one is it?
You make love and fun.
Well, at least you got Fleetwood Mac. I didn't even know that, and I didn't know the song title. I was lying when I said that. Well, lying is such a bad word, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not. I don't.
You're making it up.
I was joking. Anyway, we're here with Gary Smith. We're talking money machine and value investing. And, Gary, there's so much more that you talk about in here. One thing, you know, and it's Warren Buffett. Actually, I get mad at Warren Buffett when I hear him talk about taxes from a political point of view, because he's the master of deferring taxes. And you talk about deferring taxes also and how positive that is to your portfolio. Did we lose him?
Uh-oh.
Gary?
I'm here.
Oh, there you are. We had you on mute for some reason. But anyway, go ahead, Gary.
Okay. One thing about investing in stocks is the tax treatment is incredibly favorable. Your dividends, you pay a 15% tax, which is a lot less than on your income, of course. And then on your capital gains, you pay 15% if you sell the stock and realize the gain. But if you don't sell the stock, you hold on to it, then you make more money on money. You know, the government's essentially loaning you the money you owe them in taxes, so you can make more money. And then if you die, well, you will die. When you do die, if you pass the stock on to your heirs, they start all over again with no capital gains taxes. And so it's just an amazing investment.
So Warren Buffett's made like $50 billion on Berkshire Hathaway stock. When he dies, his children have no capital gains tax, right?
Yep.
That's unbelievable.
There might be an inheritance tax, but...
might be an estate tax, but there's no capital gains tax.
Yep, yep. And it's... I mean, the thing's kind of crazy. I have a son who just started college, and he worked teaching tennis to a bunch of kids who didn't really want to be there, and he made a couple $1,000. And then he took like $9,000 he'd accumulated, and he bought some Apple stock about a year ago, and now it's $16,000, and he's saying $7,000 for nothing. Yeah, it's a lot easier than teaching tennis to a bunch of kids who don't want to be there. And then you think about it, if I get my portfolio up to $100,000, then I'm getting $5,000, $10,000 a year for doing nothing. I get my portfolio up to $1 million, now I'm getting $50,000 to $100,000 a year for doing nothing. And it's just something people ought to do. And I met somebody, it's probably a month ago, and this family had just sold a big house they had. They were downsizing because their kids had left home and grown up. And they had $1 million in cash. And guess what they did with it? They put it in the bank earning 0.01% interest.
Yeah, you were talking about that.
And they didn't want to lose any money. And, I mean, and if they put it in the stocks, you know, who knows what's going to happen tomorrow or next week, but over the next 10 years, stocks go up 7% a year. They double their money. They got $2 million. And it's just the stock market is a great place to invest as long as you can control your emotions so you don't get scared and panic sell or you don't get greedy and buy for foolish reasons. But if you just make level-headed, put some money in good stocks and let it go, you're going to make a lot of money taxed at very low rates, and you're going to have a much more lovely lifestyle than you would otherwise.
Yeah, you know, one of the things you say in your book is never buy metals, and I'm sure that also now includes never buy crypto coins.
Yep.
You know, because there's nothing there. I mean, it's nothing. You're buying nothing.
It's like buying baseball cards or, you know, any kind of Beanie Babies, any kind of collectible. There's
you
no
talk,
cash flow whatsoever.
You talk funny about that. You talk about some card that was had an economist on the card, and you're the only one in existence today. And what could it possibly be worth, you know?
Yep. So people buy baseball cards, and they say, oh, they must be worth something because there's not very many of them. Well, I've got an economist card, and the person on the card is actually James Tobin, who you mentioned before. And it's an extremely rare card. But nobody's going to pay me anything for it. Rarity doesn't make something valuable. What makes something valuable is that it generates a lot of cash.
Yeah, and that's the important thing is that people understand that if you have a company that's earnings,
right,
and you own a piece of that company, and our governments around the world protect the ownership of assets through the stock market, you actually own something real that's worth something, earning money. And people don't understand that when they go and buy gold or they go and buy silver or whatever the case may be because somebody scared them into thinking it's going to make them a lot of money or protect them from some weird thing, they're actually making a major mistake.
Yeah. So Warren Buffett's got, I can't remember which annual report it was, but I think it was 2 years ago, he said you could take all the gold in the world and you could melt it down and put it in one big cube, I think about 60 feet on a side, it would fit inside a baseball diamond. Or you could take that money and you could buy all U.S. farmland, you could buy 11 ExxonMobils and still have $1 trillion left over to buy other stuff you want to buy. And 100 years from now, you would have all the stuff generated by the farmland, by the ExxonMobils, by all the stocks you buy. Or you could have that lump of gold that's still sitting there
Never did anything. Never made a nickel.
You could hug it, but it's not going to hug you back.
So tell people again how they get, you know, in touch with you or follow what you're talking about in your book and so forth.
Yeah, well, you can send me an email at gsmith, G-S-M-I-T-H, at pomona.edu, or you can go to garysmithn.com, or you can just Google Gary Smith Money Machine, and it pops up. There's been some stories written about, a lot of stories written about it. There's a New York Times review of it, and there's other stories, or it'll pop up because of the Amazon connection. And I've had a lot of Market Watch columns written recently, and that'll probably pop up. And also, Real Clear Markets will pop up, and they all have my email address and my website, so you can find me that way too.
So one of the things you talked about in the beginning of the book, and I totally overlooked this, and I should have talked to you about this earlier, but I might as well do it now,
sure,
is that you say markets are semi-efficient, and that's a big debate. Everyone
mm-hmm.
says, are markets efficient or are markets inefficient?
Right.
And it's a big debate if they're efficient, like the index investors and passive investors say, then you just do this and you never worry about it because they're totally efficient. You can't do anything about it. And if they're inefficient, the people who are active investors say, no, we can outperform the market, da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
And you say they're semi-efficient, which is similar to what I say. And I say that markets mm-hmm. are efficient and inefficient all at the same time. And I think that's exactly what you're saying when you say they're semi-efficient.
Yeah. And so there are some things in efficiency, like you read a story in the newspaper that Ford F-150 your sales are up. And so you say, I'm going to go out and buy the stock before somebody else does. Well, it's probably too late.
Too late.
That's not a great reason to buy a stock. On the other hand, you have things like the dot-com bubble, where prices were clearly nuts. And markets, those prices were not right. Or you've got some of the examples I give in the back of the book. There was Unilever. There's two types of Unilever. There was a Dutch kind and an English kind. Two stocks traded. And it was set up so that each shareholders would receive exactly the same dividends. If the companies were ever sold, the shareholders get exactly the same proceeds, half the proceeds. And so the two stocks, in theory, should have traded at exactly the same price. But they didn't. Sometimes it was 20% too high, sometimes 20% too low. And that is not the market always gets the price right. That is, markets sometimes do things that are stupid. You have panic selling, you have bubbly buying, you have $100 bills lying on the sidewalk because markets make mistakes. And so there are opportunities out there.
Yeah, I understand. And so we're at the last minute of the show. And so, Gary, I just wanted to, you know, point out to our listeners again the sound advice that you give in the book, which is stay away from, you know, fear things or greed things or hot tips and all that kind of stuff. And just, you know, be patient, buy good companies, and just hold them for the long term.
Exactly.
Pretty simple, you know, and that's
it is.
But
just got to control our emotions. That's
common sense.
Yeah, and you can't, right, it's common sense, but people don't want to do that. They want instant gratification. They want to be a millionaire next week. They don't want to be a millionaire in 20 years.
Yep.
They want it next week.
Exactly.
And that's Warren Buffett talks about the snowball principle, you know, get a little bit, start rolling it down the hill little by little, and by the time you get to the bottom of the hill, which sometimes can take a while, you know, you'll have a pretty good snowball.
Well, you know, the stock market's given 10% a year on average, and at that rate, your money doubles every 7 years, and that snowball gets big
mm-hmm.
really fast.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gary, we're out of time. That's what happens when we have a great guest and a great topic. I really appreciate your time being with us tonight.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I really enjoyed it.
And Robert, it was great to have you.
Thank you.
Director of Tax and Accounting for the Consulate, and you hang out in Gettysburg. We are looking forward to having you back again. Tommaso?
Yes,
next
sir.
Week, an open show,
open
right?
Open show.
This is Drew Tignanelli saying God bless.